You're listening to The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, and you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have two guests with us from different perspectives who will talk with us about the top state, national, and international news stories of the week. And we always welcome your input. What happened this week in the news that you want to talk about? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We're going to start with this crackdown on the Solidarity Singers. That's the group of singers who like to sing protest songs at the State Capitol Rotunda just about every noon hour during the week. There have been dozens and dozens of arrests this week because the singers are not getting a permit as required by the Department of Administration rules. So we'll talk about this dispute, and we'll have our two guests from different viewpoints give us their take on whether the singers are in the right or the wrong here by not getting a permit for groups of 20 or more to sing at the state capitol, or if you think the state is wrong arresting these singers who are expressing their protest through song. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let me welcome our guests in studio with us, Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Joy.
Good to have you back here on the Week in Review. Also joining us by telephone, Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive Magazine. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning.
So, Ruth, what's going on at the state capitol? Why are these Solidarity Singers, asking to be arrested?
Well, I think they are. I think the large group, including my editor at the Progressive, Matt Rothschild, who went back there yesterday, were going in protest of the arrests on Wednesday. But you know, they've been there nonstop for a couple of years, protesting what Walker is doing to the state of Wisconsin, and you know, they're raising their voices to say that they don't like what's happening to the state and to exercise their First Amendment right to petition their government. And the crackdown has happened because a year ago, Walker replaced Chief Tubbs, who got us all the way through the Wisconsin uprising, and dealt very deftly with the massive protests here about the really controversial things that were happening then and continue to happen in Wisconsin. He replaced Chief Tubbs with David Irwin, his personal bodyguard and a former Marine who vowed to evict the protesters. And he got this huge long-range acoustic device and blasted them with sound and issued these warnings and then arrested them because there were 22 of them instead of 20, which is the number that's legally allowed to gather. So, you know, I think it's pretty obvious that it's a huge overreach. You know, Walker and the Republicans control all three branches of government, and they nonetheless can't put up with this small band of protesters raising their voices in the Capitol. And it's such a huge violation of citizens' rights to express themselves or just the existence of any dissent in Wisconsin that people are coming out to say no to it.
Well, Tom Still, should these singers have to get a permit, or is the state overreach to arrest you're seeing pictures of, you know, 85-year-old women, you know, being arrested for singing at the Capitol.
Yeah. You know, there is a process. I mean, and the permitting process allows for groups of 20 or under to be there, and that's been upheld by a judge. So that's the legality of that situation. The bigger issue, it seems to me, is at this point, and it's hard to see this in the coverage, a lot of folks probably ask, what's the point? Why are they still there and still doing it? It's not, I mean, Ruth just articulated that, and they feel that it's a continuation of how they feel about Governor Walker and state policies. But I don't know that that's immediately apparent to most people. They've been there for 2 years. Their singing, by the way, is getting really good. I mean, of course,
have you heard them recently?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And after 2 years, I mean, maybe I'd be Pavarotti too. But that's I think the point that probably strikes a lot of people is why what's there and what's the continuing message that they're trying to get out? How is it different from what it was when they started? How is it perhaps the same? That part is just I think in some ways in the public eye unclear.
Well, you know, it's a little confusing, too, in terms of the number of people that you need to get a permit for. It used to be that the Department of Administration rules said that a group of four or more needed to get a permit, but then this federal judge struck that down. He said, mm-hmm. that's too few.
Right.
You could enforce, say, if 20 or more people are there, you could, you know, then you can enforce it. So it kind of changed, and, you know, 22 people show up spontaneously. It doesn't say the state has to enforce it.
Well, yeah. And the truth be known, I mean, you know, you get a school tour in the rotunda of the Capitol, and it's probably going to exceed 20. So, but maybe that's an example of a permit. And obviously the four was way too few. You could have four friends meeting randomly and exceed that.
You know, I mean, these are games that they're playing to try. You know, basically what it is the Republicans and their staff who work in the Capitol and the Walker administration don't like the protests. They were not prepared for 100,000 people protesting in the Capitol. The things that those people were protesting continue to advance in our state, and we have this incredible budget document that the governor just signed. You know, the mining issue up north. I mean, there are a lot of things that people are coming to the Capitol to protest, and they're really some of the same things that they've been protesting all along. I mean, our state continues to be driven by this very radical right-wing corporate agenda. But the permit, you know, the language on the permits is what shows how ridiculous what Walker, through his bodyguard David Irwin, is doing. And what he's doing is he's saying, oh my God, there's 22 people. If there's more than 20, you need a permit. Therefore, as these little kids are standing around, by the way, those school tours don't have this special permit, because it's always been the case that people could come and go in our state capitol, right? I mean, this is what happened during the protests when they closed the whole place down and locked all the doors. And it was a grotesque overreach. It was the governor saying, you know, this is not a building that you can come into, and I don't want to hear what you have to say, and if you keep saying it, I'm going to haul you out of here. So the district judge, William Conley, did issue this temporary ruling that it was groups of 20 or fewer that didn't need a permit, so they wait till there's 22 people, and they stage this massive crackdown. It's just, you know, there's no fundamental justice on their side.
Well, Ruth, what do you think's going to happen here? Are the singers just going to keep on showing up and more arrests and try to work this all out finally in court?
Yeah, I think that is what's going to happen, because I think that they really aren't accepting the idea that not only will they have no ability to stop what the governor and the Republicans are doing in the state, but they won't even be able to talk about it in the Capitol building. I mean, I think people just fundamentally are opposed to that idea. And so folks like the 85 and 80-year-old grandparents who were arrested, who are the parents of one of our writers, actually, Rebecca Campbell, and she wrote a piece on our Progressive Magazine website about their first arrest in their life. You know, I think they feel like that it's not an option to cave in to this and say, well, I guess there won't be any political dissent in the state of Wisconsin. I mean, people are really frustrated and they want to express themselves. And I think this kind of behavior by the governor it has not so far resulted in people giving up.
Well, let me ask you, though, Ruth, the critics who say, you know, fine, the Solidarity Singers don't like Governor Walker or the policies of this state leadership. But every single noon hour, people have to hear this singing going on, and other groups are trying to hear the tour guide, but this singing is going on, or whatever the case may be. What's the defense of that? Is it really necessary? The state is saying this is disrupting others,
If they don't like the songs, I'm not sure that means that they can drag people into the basement, zip tie them. You know, I mean, really, I find the Solidarity Sing Along to be kind of a nice feature of Wisconsin. I think a lot of people come to the Capitol and enjoy it. I had friends visiting who went downtown to see it. You know, it comes down to politics, the objection to it. And I think, actually, as Tom said sort of jokingly, they sound good. And when I have been there, you know, I have really kind of enjoyed seeing this many generations of people. And, you know, what are people going to do? I mean, you talk about sort of the futility of their gesture. Well, look, I mean, you know, obviously, if you don't like what's happening in Wisconsin, there are a lot of different fronts that fight needs to happen on. We had an incredible, historic you know, internationally famous citizen outpouring here a couple of years ago. And the idea that that should dwindle down to, you know, you're not allowed to stand around the Capitol in groups larger than 20 and, you know, everyone's going to be quiet and just put up with what's happening to our state. I mean, it's just not an acceptable outcome.
And you know, there's an important point that you raised in a way, Joy. It's the Capitol really isn't just one group's forum. It is, first of all, it's a workplace. There are Democratic and Republican legislators and their staffs and other people who are actually working there day in, day out. And there are folks who go through the rotunda on a regular basis and tours and whatever else may be going on. And it's true. I mean, it can drown out some other things. So I think it's still important that while they may sound better, they got to get the lyrics right. And what are the lyrics? What at this point is the enduring point that they're trying to make?
Well, here, you know, let me jump in. During the height of the protest, when there was a wedding in the Capitol, Chief Tubbs went down and got an enormous group of people to be quiet, to step aside, and to get out of the way for the wedding photography. There was a lot of goodwill. I mean, this is not, I think a lot of the right-wing blogs have portrayed the Solidarity Singers and all the protesters at the Capitol as these awful thugs. These are not. You know, these are people, if you live in Madison, who you know and you see around, and are a friendly group of, you know, retired teachers and folks who work downtown. So, you know, it's not like this is an uncontrollable situation and that it merits the kind of crackdown that we're seeing.
Yeah, Anne in Madison emails, I think the protesters need to put away their signs, gather and sing the normal versions of patriotic songs, God Bless America, My Country 'Tis of Thee, then see if they get arrested. That will determine if the law is just discriminating against anti-Walker protesters. What about that, Tom?
No, it's an interesting point, although I think from time to time they have done precisely that.
Well, what if their point is one of the songs they sing is Governor Walker won't be governor one day? They want him to lose the next election. Is that not good enough?
It may well be. And again, as I noted, I mean, in some ways it would be interesting to hear what that real message is, other than sort of an overall solidarity message, which I understand. And that's there are a lot of different forms for that. But I think one of the questions for a lot of people out there is, geez, really? 2 years? What is the message right now?
The message is it hasn't gotten better yet, you know, and that things are, you know, there's some stuff going on in our state that people really don't like. And if you listen to the lyrics of the songs, which are quite creative, they address those issues really specifically. Free speech is becoming a more prominent part of it, but you know, just the tax breaks for the wealthy and the fact that we're now going to pay more taxes in Wisconsin to not provide Medicaid expansion, you know, health insurance for the working poor. I mean, there's a whole lot going on in our state that people are really feeling upset about. And this is a pretty small group of folks who are expressing it in a creative and fun way. And by the way, you know, when you say the Capitol is not a forum just for one group, the Capitol is, as you know, as we all heard a lot during the uprising, it's the people's house. It's a forum for democracy. So it isn't Walker's personal office building. And he can't squash political speech that he doesn't like there just because he wants to.
Josie in Menominee is with us. Hello, Josie.
Hi. I'd like to say, maybe mostly to Ruth there, that we're dealing with two different issues here. One is, you know, whether you like or don't like what Governor Walker stands for. The other is the law. Now, it's a rule, and the rule says that you need a permit if you're more than 20 people. So if you break that rule, it's perfectly within the law and with everything that's right and legal to arrest these people. And we're not saying they don't have freedom of speech. We're saying the law is this, and there's reasons why they put that law in there. They're coming.
Yeah, they put
every
it in there to stop the Solidarity Singers.
No, but the law is there. I mean, the rule. We'll call it a rule. And so, to me, the issue isn't whether you like Governor Walker or what he's doing or not doing, or whether you have freedom of speech. The issue to me right here is: here's a rule. When you break this rule, the law is allowed to come in and tell you, this is the punishment for breaking the rule. Yeah. We're not trying to take away your freedom of speech.
Just get a permit, Ruth. Why don't the Solidarity Singers do that?
Well, I don't think that they expect that permit will be granted. And I think that they don't know how many people are going to show up at any given time. But if you want to look at what is specifically ridiculous about the rule argument. They have jockeyed around trying to make rules to keep people out of the Capitol. They declared this state emergency and locked all the doors for a while. Remember when the Democratic legislators took their desks out the window and sat on the lawn? They themselves couldn't get into their office. I mean, the struggle to control the Capitol building and to control what goes on in there has been sort of a graphic illustration of what's happened to our entire state government. And it's a real violation of sort of a basic citizen access to government. So, you know, there were 22 people. The rule says 20, so therefore they take out this crazy loud device, blast these 80-year-olds in the ear, and arrest every single person, not two, but all 22. So, you know, I think it's pretty clear that this is not about, you know, the importance of this rule. The rule was made in order to try to quash people.
Well, we'll give Tom a last word on this topic as we need to move on to some other issues.
Sure. I mean, I think the caller made a great point. Perhaps the solidary singers can simply test the permit system and apply for a permit. I'm not aware of an upward limit on the number of people. I think it what I have seen and heard shows that it's 20 and more. And if they apply and it's turned down, who knows? Maybe that makes their point.
Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Ruth Conniff is political editor of the Progressive Magazine. They are our two guests for this edition of the Week in Review. Coming up, we'll have some news about the proposed iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin and how Iron County officials are working to evict the tribal harvest camp that is located there. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the new poll numbers on Governor Scott Walker's job performance. We'll talk about some more state politics. Senate President Mike Ellis has a Democratic challenger. We'll find out more about that. And we welcome the issues you want to talk about. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine with Ruth Conniff and Tom Still, talking about the top state, national, and international news stories of the week, and welcoming the news story that you want to talk about, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll talk about some state issues now. We will, a little bit later in the program, talk about President Obama's economic speech tour, trying to refocus Congress, Washington, on the economy and off of what he calls phony scandals. So let's talk about this news coming up in Iron County, other protest-related news. Iron County officials are working to evict the tribal harvest camp located near the Gogebic Taconite mine site. Members of the county board are urging criminal and civil penalties for this encampment. Ruth Conniff, what do you make of this, getting rid of the harvest camp at that proposed mine site? These are the Native American tribes from around the area.
Well, I think that this is directly related to what's happening in the Capitol in terms of squashing dissent, and it's Walker's DNR threatening to remove the Forest Committee in Iron County's certification, and which includes funding for forestry jobs, if they let the tribe stay. And that is really the reason that this Tuesday morning meeting of this committee happened. It was a Monday meeting that we reported at the Progressive on Tuesday morning. So the Forest Committee in Iron County in May, 2 months ago, the same committee unanimously approved extending the 14-day camping ordinance for this group of tribes and letting them stay for a year because it was a tribal gathering. And then they went behind closed doors, and instead they're slapping them with these unanticipated criminal charges. So what the heck happened? Why was it okay 2 months ago, and now suddenly it's criminal behavior? Well, they haven't said anything to the tribes about that. They didn't see that coming. And I think what has happened is, you remember that the mining company, GTAC, which you pronounced so well.
Gogebic.
It's hard to say. Had hired this weird out-of-state paramilitary group, Bulletproof Security, that was surrounding the mine because they don't like the protesters and they're trying to scare people off the land. they were forced to leave because they were operating illegally in the state without a permit. And immediately, right-wing bloggers started demanding that the campers of the tribes be evicted also. And Walker, through the DNR and his, pattern of intolerance towards any dissent in the state, towards, you know, what he's doing, has found a way to twist arms up there to force the tribes off the land. Well, what's going to happen? They're going to meet, the whole county board is going to meet on July 30th and take up this issue of the criminal penalties. And then this is going to go to federal court where the treaty rights of these tribes are going to completely trump Walker's arm twisting of the DNR after the state spends millions and millions of dollars on this lawsuit.
Yeah. So what's the point, Tom Still?
Well, I think Ruth's right. I mean, this is another example of what are the parameters around free speech and peaceful protest in a democratic society. So it really is a similar issue. In this case, I am not aware personally of anything that the tribal encampment has done to be less than peaceful. There could be something I'm not aware of there, but so that, let's get that out there right away. It's an issue that has really left that region of the state and kind of raw in many ways. And I was just up there. Our board of directors met in Ashland recently. We were hearing, all sides of this issue. There are limits though on what can be done on this kind of land and for how long. And there are certain things laid out in the law about the use of and access to those public lands. So this is going to, I think it's going to play out over time. It's an issue that is, the overall mine and what's going to happen there or not in time is of such importance to that region and to the state. It certainly merits watching.
Also related to the mine, Senators Dale Schultz, Bob Jauch, and Tim Cullen have introduced legislation for workplace safety on the mine site. This is, they say, intended to protect the workers for the mine company while still allowing public access to the site. Do you have any thoughts, Tom, whether this sounds like a fair compromise or not?
Well, I think it's part of that whole process of trying to draw the lines in a more, rational way. Certainly all three of those senators have followed that process pretty closely. It is also about the safety of the mine workers who are there, as well as others who may be almost innocent bystanders, who may otherwise be on land up there and be caught in something that they don't want to be caught in. Now, the one issue will be the legislature really doesn't return, I don't think, until September 17th through 19th. How quickly could such a bill pass and be implemented? And perhaps they're thinking about this being some sort of an emergency rule that could go through the Joint Finance Committee or some other committee to start that process sooner.
Yeah, any thoughts on this, Ruth?
Yeah, I think that what's going on here is that this out-of-state mining company, which has managed to write the law, and Governor Walker was very clear, actually Sean Johnson of Wisconsin Public Radio reported on, Governor Walker basically saying, look, this is what the mining company wants. They wrote the law suspending regulation so that they could pursue this 22-mile-long strip mine in this environmentally sensitive area where there's a lot of tourism and a lot of other, uses for that land. And now they're saying they're going to close access to thousands of acres, and the pretext for that is the safety of their workers. So Senator Jauch and Schultz and Cullen, who had also proposed compromise legislation that would not completely subvert the authority of the DNR and not get rid of open meetings on the issue, and were told by Walker, I talked to the mine company executive, and that's not what he wanted, and they wouldn't accept that compromise. Now they're trying for a compromise that would allow tourism to continue in the area and people to be able to get on this land instead of what the company wants, which is, quote-unquote, worker safety by closing access, for hunters and fishermen and hikers and everybody else. So they're saying, well, how about let's look at worker safety seriously. The provisions are within 50 feet of a drilling operation. You can't come that close. Within 300 feet of a site where there's bulk sampling going on. I mean, it's really calling the mining companies bluff and saying, you want to talk about safety? Here's some reasonable safety regulations. And let's see if Walker and the mine company owner, who seem to be the ones driving the bus here, are willing to accept this rather than saying to the people of northern Wisconsin, sorry, tourism industry, sorry, tribes, you're not going to be able to come on this land. It's not Wisconsin's land. It's GTEC's land.
Let me take Mason in Mauston. That's a tongue twister. Mason, go ahead.
My question is, you know, I'm fed up with the nonsense in this country and in this state. You know, you've got people from Madison and you've got people from Milwaukee and all these southern counties that's saying that this county up north that wants to open a strip mine, bring in some type of revenue into their county, and saying, no, they can't. You know, what is it of my business what they do up there? If the people up there decide that's what they want to do, they should have that free will and that right. That's their county. That's where they live.
Thank you, Mason. Thank you, Mason. Ruth, is that what's happening here?
Well, I mean, if that were what's happening, then you wouldn't see people forming these camps and protests, and you wouldn't see the Walker administration closing down open meetings on the issue, and you wouldn't see people, you know, the representatives of that area struggling so hard to try to balance the economic interests of the area and the jobs that could be created by the mine against the immense destruction that it could also wreak to the local economy as well as the environment.
I think there are a lot of good people in northern Wisconsin. And again, we were just up there, got a chance to talk to some of the people who are representatives and local officials and school officials and others. And they're looking to manage this in a way that does mesh with the region. In this sense, there's some truth to what the caller said, that there are a lot of people from outside that region who want to call more shots than perhaps they can or should. When at this point, the state law has been changed. I mean, the mining regulations in Wisconsin now look a lot like the mining regulations in Minnesota. And that is private land that is owned by the mine. There is surrounded by a lot of public land, and up to this point, there has been access allowed to the private land. But at some point, it becomes more of a local issue in terms of how certain aspects of this are managed.
We need to move on to some state politics. And something that, Tom Steele, you brought up in the news break just before we started, I'm reminded with Representative Dale Schultz, he's a Republican from Richland Center, pairing up with two Democrats on this particular legislation. He's known to split from the Republican Party on some issues, and mm-hmm. he's facing a potential primary challenger, and some fundraising numbers came out that you thought were particularly interesting.
Yeah, and Senator Schultz is you know, he's been a strong independent voice on a lot of issues, and he's being challenged, though, by Representative Howard Markline, and some of the early fundraising numbers would suggest that there's a bit of a gap there in terms of what Senator Schultz has raised versus Representative Markline, and that may be just an indicator that Senator Schultz has yet to decide whether he will run.
Yeah. And do you have any comments on this, Ruth?
Well, they have been threatening to primary Dale Schultz for a long time because he has broken with the Republican Party under Walker and, you know, obviously historically resisted Act 10. And he's a thorn in the side, and for, you know, a brief time was the tipping point vote when the Democrats had, you know, half and he plus one plus Dale Schultz to try to resist Walker's disempowerment of the unions and the other legislation that he's rammed through. So it's you know, that is part of the plan for the Tea Party takeover of the Republican Party, both in our state and nationally, to primary moderate Republicans.
Democratic State Representative Penny Bernard Schaber from Appleton says that she will challenge Republican Senate President Mike Ellis for the seat that he has held in the Wisconsin State Senate since 1982. Why should she do this, Ruth Conniff?
Well, Mike Ellis has become kind of a symbol of the Republican overreach in the state legislature. He is obviously very powerful. And he is also a real showman. So when he, you know, yells at Senator Fred Risser, the oldest senator in the state, to sit down and shut up during debate, or when he cracked the gavel base hammering so hard to make Democrats stop talking during the debate on forced ultrasound in our state, which was such a big national issue, he gets a lot of YouTube play, and he sort of represents this snarling, angry, intolerant sort of right-wing face of the Republican Party. But the truth is that Ellis is also a behind-the-scenes deal-maker, and that he was not in favor of one of the most radical things the Walker administration has wanted to do to our state, which is to voucherize our public school system. He got rid of special needs vouchers in the budget, and also he resisted the idea that vouchers would be imposed on communities around the state without any local input as a really undemocratic thing that's going to drain resources from the public schools, give money to private school parents, and potentially close schools all over the state. He made a deal behind the scenes, as only he could, really, to slow down that school choice juggernaut, which is a huge force in our in politics in our state. But it wasn't a good deal. And what happened was that for in exchange for a very small increase in public school funding, it's a quarter of the cut that was made in the last budget, he has allowed the statewide expansion of vouchers. And this is a big deal for his constituents because it could really take down a lot of public schools. And so what his opponent is saying is that he needs to be held accountable for that. And then for some other things that are happening in this budget that are just really bad, and I think Ellis knows they're bad, like the rejection of federal Medicaid money so that Wisconsin taxpayers will pay more in order to not insure the working poor in our state, and the deregulation that went on with the GTAC mine. So, you know, it is important. It's a really important stance to take to raise these issues and to run against Ellis, and he's a really powerful guy.
Yeah, Ellis of Neenah, second longest tenure of any state senator, 31 years experience. He also served 12 years in the Assembly before being elected to the Senate. He has been uncontested in the last three previous elections. Tom Still, is he defeatable?
Oh, you know, that particular district, I think, is a little tighter in terms of the partisan split. That if you look at it in terms of voting patterns, including some presidential votes, than you might expect. But it, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Mike Ellis, not unlike Dale Schultz, has and Ruth just alluded to this, has got an independent side on some issues over time. You know, he's one of the relative handful of people who kind of understand how school funding formula work. An arcane topic, but it's an important one. Then again, now Representative Bernard Schaber is also an independent voice. I think she's a good fit to challenge in that kind of district because she really doesn't come from what might be seen as a classic Democratic outlook on some issues. She's been an effective representative. So I fully expect that to be a strong race.
Well, there is also talk about Trek executive Mary Burke running for governor on the Democratic ticket. Meanwhile, Winnebago County Executive Mark Harris says he might run too. We just heard a story this morning from Sean Johnson that he's going to wait until, I guess, Labor Day to decide. And he thinks that it would benefit the race if there was a primary. So would that be a good thing, a Democratic primary, Tom Still?
Oh, I would think so. Despite the fact that there are people who care or feel very strongly that they don't like Governor Walker, the Democrats can't defeat him with no one. So I think the process of selecting a candidate on the Democratic side is going to be probably pretty vigorous. Mark Harris, don't know him personally, but it sounds like in Winnebago County he's done a good job of being county executive. That is an executive role, which there's some parallels there with being governor. And certainly Mary Burke, she's got a great family name, comes from a great company. She was the Commerce Secretary for at least one stint under Governor Doyle. And there may be others who come out. you know, I think that a primary on the Democratic side probably makes some sense because they have to decide who they are.
So your thoughts, Ruth, kind of on whether there should be or will be a Democratic primary?
Yeah, I mean, I'm for more democracy, and I don't think that the party, the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, should just install a candidate. I think the reason that there is any debate at all about that is because since Walker raised $30 million in the recall and is just a fundraising juggernaut the likes of which Wisconsin has never seen before, people are worried about marshaling the resources to combat him, even though his popularity is on the decline. Wisconsin trails both the nation and the region in job creation, even though he made that his signature issue in his first campaign. You know, we've had these huge scandals. We have these right-wing social policies now. We look like Mississippi. There's a lot of discontent. There's a lot of room to run a really vigorous campaign, and we saw the grassroots energy in the recall effort. I mean, there should be a tremendous amount of energy poured into this campaign. But, you know, we saw the power of Walker and his network of out-of-state funders in that recall election, and a lot of people look at that and they're intimidated to even step up. So that's why you hear particular enthusiasm about candidates like Mary Burke, who could self-finance, and also Kevin Conroy, another millionaire possible candidate who could self-finance. And I think that's part of the reason that people like Tom Nelson and Mark Harris would need to get going really soon to start raising some money to combat that Walker machine. But I think that the thing about Mary Burke, who to me sounds like the most interesting candidate of those who we've heard about, is that she is, as Tom points out, a businesswoman. She actually, you know, while Walker's been on the public payroll all of his life, and he talks a lot about job creators, Mary Burke has been a job creator. She ran Trek Bicycle, her dad's company. She ran its European operations in 7 countries. She's been deeply involved in public service and started the Avid Tops program, which is a very successful program that helps low-income and minority kids in Madison public schools. She has done a lot of really interesting stuff, and she could really run against Walker's abysmal record on job creation very credibly as a business person.
Let me jump in, Ruth, because we're past our break time. We will come back. We'll talk a little bit more about Governor Walker's job approval, job performance ratings, President Obama's job performance ratings, according to the latest Marquette University Law School poll. We'll also talk about President Obama kicking off the series of speeches to try to refocus Washington on the economy. And we will have our Week in Review quiz question. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. Time now for the Week in Review quiz. A well-known national publication which began in Madison 25 years ago printed its last Madison edition this week on Thursday. What was it? What is it? A well-known national publication printed its last Madison edition on Thursday. What was it? 1-800-642-1234. If you think you know, we'll give you 5 minutes to call in your answer. You can also email us, talk@wpr.org. We'll randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers, and you will be entitled to one of the books that we featured on the program recently. The answer and the winner at the end of the show. I'm Joy Cardine with Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, and Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive magazine, reviewing the news of the week during this edition of the Week in Review. Well, according to the most recent Marquette University Law School poll, Governor Walker's ratings have slipped below 50%. Only 48% of respondents approve of the job he is doing. Well, do you think this is significant, Tom Still?
You know, and I think you can see the same thing in President Obama's ratings. People who make decisions, political leaders who make decisions, sometimes are not going to make everybody happy. And if you're between terms, which Governor Walker is, and certainly President Obama is, he was reelected, but in the midst of this term, I think, you know, history would show that's the kind of drift that you see in those poll figures for a lot of people, regardless of party, who are going to be in those kind of executive positions. Now, and it gets back to our earlier conversation. That may be true, that 48% is his approval rating on his job approval. But I think on the flip side, that it was still a lower number on the disapproval. So it gets back to as the Democrats sort through the variety of, you know, good candidates they may have moving ahead. It's still tough to beat an incumbent, and so that's one of the things that is pretty apparent about that.
Ruth, maybe you can also talk about the fact that President Obama and Governor Walker's job approval rating slipped below 50%.
Well, people are hurting economically, and that is the bottom line. And I think what you see in Wisconsin is that even though we've had the most divisive governor in history, and even though he's done some things like bring us, you know, vaginal ultrasound, which is not in a supposed job creation session, which is not what the people of Wisconsin were looking for, or about school vouchers, which are not popular statewide. We were told that we would put up with all this stuff and then we would have jobs. And that was always the rationale for what Walker was doing in Wisconsin. Well, guess what? We have half the rate of job growth of the national average, and we trail all of our neighboring states. We're about even with Illinois. But we look bad in terms of job creation, and people feel that very personally because they don't have jobs. You know, they have kids who are loaded down with student debt and can't find jobs. And they're, you know, at the end of the day, you can talk all you want, but if that is the environment that you're producing in your state, it's not going to sell. And, you know, it's the rejection of the federal Medicaid money, although there's a whole lot of, you know, hot air about it, means that a whole lot of these same people who are the working poor who are really struggling are also going to be denied their opportunity to get health insurance now. So I just think those things catch up with you when you're a political leader, and that's what we're seeing in the polls.
Well, President Obama kicked off a series of economic speeches this week. Major themes have included building up the middle class, investing in infrastructure and education, and getting away from what he calls phony scandals and slash-and-burn politics in Congress. Republicans are criticizing the speeches as a waste of time. Well, Tom Still, does the president have a point? Should Congress be refocused on the economy and not phony scandals?
Well, I don't know how phony some of these scandals are in terms of, you know, the IRS and Benghazi, and the list is somewhat long. At the same time, yes, focusing on the economy continues to make great sense. And that's at the national level, at the state level, any way you want to cut it. Here nationally, I think the phrase that some people have begun to use is the joyless recovery, that it's, you know, it's been so slow and so grinding that you know, a lot of people are wondering what is next. And here in Wisconsin, it's always been true. You can go back as long as you want, that Wisconsin enters a recession later and exits a recession later. And so that's why I think, you know, one of the reasons why we're just going to start to build momentum now in terms of rebuilding on the job side. And then we're in a point where an economy can recover, and it's not necessarily going to produce jobs the way it did in the past for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is technology, which we're familiar with through our organization. So, and jobs are in different ways now. A lot of people are working more independently. They're not necessarily employed by large corporations. Small businesses in the United States create all net new jobs. And so I think that's part of the trends that we need to understand here in Wisconsin as well as nationally.
Ruth.
I think the president's speech was great. You know, I think that he is giving a series of economic speeches to connect with Americans about what real people's priorities are, which, you know, he talks a lot about the middle class, and of course the Democrats don't like to talk about the poor, but, you know, we're talking about both groups, neither of which have seen any benefit from, you know, the increased economic activity of the last 10 years. All of those benefits have accrued to the top 1% of Americans. So we're seeing, you know, we're looking more and more like a really stratified third world country. And this is not the vision of America that most of us have. So he's laying out a fundamental ideological difference with the Republican Party, talking about, you know, how you grow an economy and what you do. You know, you see in Detroit, we're talking about slashing guaranteed retirement benefits for folks who get $19,000 a year on average, but continuing to build a pro hockey stadium. I mean, these are not the kinds of priorities that benefit most Americans. And I think the president should use his bully pulpit and get out and talk about raising the minimum wage, as he mentioned in his speech, you know, lifting some of the burden, the crushing burden of student debt, instead of allowing the banks to charge huge interest rates, letting people refinance their student debt at a reasonable rate. You know, these are the kinds of changes that could really put money in the pockets of people who will spend that money and spur economic growth. So that's the case that he's making, and it's a winning case. And unfortunately, on a policy level, you know, we don't see as much of the real, you know, rubber hitting the road as we'd like to. Now we're talking about maybe Larry Summers as Fed chair. He's, you know, he's the architect of bank deregulation. So it's a strange thing with Obama. I mean, those of us who really support these kinds of speeches and are cheered to hear them are thrilled when we hear the speeches, and then, you know, on a policy level, it'd be nice to see more. But I think it is true that the Republicans have done their best to obstruct, you know, as was their publicly declared goal, obstruct absolutely everything he tried to get done. And that is a fair criticism.
Just very quickly, as we're running short on time, I promised a listener in our open line that we held earlier this morning that I would ask you both about this proposal in the U.S. House of Representatives that would eliminate door-to-door mail delivery. It's Representative Daryl Issa says that a lot of money can be saved by putting mail curbside boxes called cluster boxes rather than going right up to someone's door. The listener wanted to know, why do Republicans hate the Postal Service? Tom Still?
I'm not sure. I mean, our letter carrier, our neighborhood is a great guy. I think that, you know, certainly the Postal Service has gone through a real revolution in terms of its mission and what's, you know, all of the different competition that it faces from package carriers to email. So I think the kind of thinking that's going on is at least got to prompt some different ways of doing business, because I think everybody wants the Postal Service to survive, but they've probably got to take a look at it.
Well, I'm just going to leave it there, because we have just time to congratulate Gavin, who is the winner of today's Week in Review question. Which national publication ended distribution in Madison, the place it originated 25 years ago this week? The answer is The Onion. Capital Newspapers decided to not renew its distribution contract with the satirical newspaper The Onion, and the last Madison issue ran Thursday with the headline, "Print dead at 1,803. So, are you going to miss the Onion printed copy, Ruth?
Absolutely. I love the Onion. I think they're hilarious and brilliant and a fine Madison product, and it's too bad.
Yeah. Is print dead, Tom, still?
No. I think print has evolved, and it just gets back to what we were talking about in the Postal Service. There's going to be new and different ways of doing it. I think there are specialty print publications that remain very vigorous. I think newspapers are coming back in some ways because they're looking for different channels. So, no.
All right, says the former newspaper guy.
Yes.
Not in the business anymore.
That's right.
Ruth Conniff, Tom Still, thank you both very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive Magazine, and Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. And thank you for listening. Thanks to Christy Taylor, to Justin Williams for producing and directing this program. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The world moves fast, and our new show, Central Time, helps you keep up. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
From breaking news to the latest in music, technology, and public debate, we're at the leading edge of what matters most.
We talk with experts and policymakers, but we also want to know what's on your mind as we celebrate the richness of Wisconsin and the people who make it great.
Join us for Central Time, weekday afternoons from 3 until 6.
Catch us right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you to the corporate sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like Madison Gas and Electric, Al Johnson's Swedish Restaurant, and Rittenhouse play a huge role in the success of WPR. For more information, go to WPR.org/sponsor.